Okay. Welcome everybody, and welcome to the talk. And thanks a lot to the organizers to give me the opportunity to speak here, and also to actually develop a little bit further the topics that Jörg had started to present. But then actually starting with, in fact, NV centers, but then take a rather strong detour, taking some of those principles and bring them into a rather different field, namely biology, which are also open systems. And then actually I come back to the quantum simulation aspects of that. And so let's get started. And I mean, Jörg mentioned already that one way of perhaps building a quantum simulator that might operate at moderately cold temperatures, maybe at 4 Kelvin or something like that, could be to actually place electron or nuclear spins on the surface of diamond or into diamond and use light to manipulate them. And so what we had thought a while ago was, as Jörg mentioned already, this idea that we take, for let's say, a diamond surface, and we are treating it chemically such that it is terminated with fluorine, and fluorine has a nuclear spin 1/2 degree of freedom, and then study actually the magnetic dynamics of such a system, which is dipolarly interacting between the nuclei, and actually with an interaction strength that in this system would be 2π × 7 kHz. And you had seen earlier on in Jörg's talk that actually coherence times and T1 times of nuclear spins, especially at lower temperatures and in strong magnetic field, can be really very long, very much exceeding such a time scale. And so there might be a hope that some system of that type could be an interesting quantum simulator model. But how actually would you control this system? Well, I mean, it's also evident from Jörg's lecture. What you would have to do is you would have to place near these nuclear spin arrays a color center, for example, an NV center, and bring it so close, so within a few nanometers, such that it can interact coherently with the nuclear spin array. And this is possible in principle and also in practice. It has, I mean, these ideas have been demonstrated in the sense that you can bring an NV center close to the surface and you can interact with external spins. You can detect their presence, you can see where they are, and so on. So in principle, that's possible. And then the basic idea of such a simulator would run as follows. The first thing is we would actually have to initialize the nuclear spins in a pure quantum state, ideally the ground state. So, and the easiest way to do that would be to say first, we try and make sure by external control, by decoupling fields, that the nuclear spins are not interacting with each other. And then we use the NV center to extract, to cool them, to extract polarization from them, to bring them all into the spin down state, which is the ground state of this non-interacting system. And then we would gradually switch on the interaction again, and in this manner, transfer this non-interacting ground state into the ground state of the interacting system. And depending in which way I switch on the interaction and what interaction type I end up with, I will get one ground state of one or the other Hamiltonian. And I have to do this slow enough so that I don't create too many excitations. But I also have to be fast enough to survive any decoherence. So there has to be a sweet spot, and at least theoretically this seems to be feasible in principle. And then you could imagine of studying a phenomena like that you create the drive the Hamiltonian the system into the ground state of this type of Hamiltonian or that type of Hamiltonian that differ by the ratio of interaction strengths between different layers of nuclei. And so in principle, these with microwave and radio frequency control, these different Hamiltonians can be constructed, and you can choose by your external control where you're ending up with. And then these might have different phases, and then you can measure the magnetic response of the system and you can discriminate the phases. So that's sort of an idea for building a quantum simulator that might work at maybe at room temperature, more likely at liquid helium temperature or something like that. But so that's a nice vision, but I actually don't want to talk too much about this. I want to go to the very first point here. I want to go to the actual cooling of the nuclear spin system. And so how this is done is, again, this is, we are using an NV center, as I mentioned before. And actually, in a way, the NV center is a small thermodynamic engine, a fridge, refrigerator, in fact, that uses control fields, namely microwave fields and laser fields, to couple nuclear spin degrees of freedom, first to the electron spin degree of freedom by achieving certain resonances that Jörg explained, and then using the laser light to transfer to connect the electron spin to the free radiation field. And why do I be doing this? Because the free radiation field has an energy scale that is 2 electron volts, which is much higher than room temperature. So that means the free radiation field is essentially in the ground state and very pure. And therefore, we are connecting something that might be at room temperature very impure with something very pure. So this is our cooling substance. And we are driving the entropy from the nuclear spins into the photons and thereby cooling them. So that's really, that's a little refrigerator. And it's indeed an interesting question. What is the optimal performance of such a device? And it's actually further complicated by the fact that actually, the system that we are cooling is not just one nuclear spin. It's actually typically an interacting nuclear spin system. And there are additional effects are taking place. And this is actually what I want to talk about now. And they are exactly related to the effects that Jörg has observed. So let us take what we quantum technologists usually like the most. Let's take a perfect system. Pure quantum dynamics, no noise, everything is completely uniform, no disorder, nothing. Let's take such an NV center, take a spin ensemble around that of that type, and let's just use this NV center to cool the spin ensemble. And when you're trying to do this, you will actually see that it doesn't work at all, or it doesn't work very well at all. Here you see various spins, and here you see nuclear spins, and here you see that some spins that are closer to the NV center are getting polarized, but many of the other ones here are actually not getting polarized. And that's already in almost in steady state, so you can see here a time evolution of the polarization of the nuclear spin ensemble, and it's just a few percent, and it's gonna saturate soon after this. So it's getting stuck. So why is that? Well, when you're looking at this, then in a big spin system, this is hard to understand. So let's take the simplest paradigmatic example that explains that. And that is 3 spins. And we will have this spin, which will be in contact with the NV center. And these 2 are the ones where this spin can exchange excitations by diffusion. So, and you can see initially they are completely mixed, spin up, spin down is equal probability. And now I come with my NV center and I make one cooling cycle. So I extract one bit of entropy from this spin and send it to the free radiation field. So I do this. So now this spin is polarized. And now, of course, we have diffusion dynamics. And so now you would say, okay, great. So there's some spins here, some entropy here. It will flow here. Very good. So it flows down here. Maybe here the entropy is now lower. It's again here. So I come with my NV center. I cool again. And then I repeat this again. And I cool again. And now everything is nice and cold. This is what you would have expected. But this is not what is happening here. Because in this particular system, the real stationary state will be a mixture of this perfectly cooled state and a state where this one, this qubit is, this nuclear spin is spin down, and these 2 are in a singlet state. And why is that? Because this state, this singlet state here, will not actually diffuse to the 3rd spin here, because destructive interference, because if the couplings here are the same, then we have a destructive interference for propagation into this spin. And so you're getting stuck. So you can say from polarization point of view, that's really bad because you're not very strongly polarized. From a quantum state preparation point of view, that's actually kind of cool because by damping, you have created a maximally entangled state in between 2 of the qubits in your system. So in this case, nuclear spins. And that's actually exactly something that we had thought of a long time ago in terms of cavity QED, but this is the perfect analog of of this idea from cavity QD, how to use dissipation to actually make entangled states. But here, this is something that we don't want for this moment. Yeah, this might be interesting what you can do with it, but here we don't want this. So how can we get around this? Well, one way is simply, let's introduce some local dephasing on all the nuclear spins. Let's disrupt this destructive interference. And if we do this, then indeed, this singlet state here will not be perfectly stable anymore, because sometimes it flips the phases and goes to a triplet, and then it can diffuse, and therefore, gradually, the polarization will be going to this spin and then be siphoned away by the NV center. And this is what you can see in the simulation. It's the same system, but we put local dephasing on it. And now you see that nicely the polarization actually spreads through the system, and it goes quite high, and it will also go a little bit higher in this simulation. Okay, so that's fine. So dephasing actually can be useful for certain applications. Now, let's go even further, because if you have a good thing, why not more of a good thing? So why not having more dephasing? Well, if the dephasing becomes too strong, then true, you're still suppressing the formation of dark states, but actually, when it's so strong, then it may also suppress the diffusion between nuclear spins. If the dephasing rate is stronger than the internuclear spin coupling, it will be suppressed, there's no diffusion anymore, and then your polarization dynamics becomes worse again. And that's what you also see again in this simulation nicely. It's a little bit better than the noise-free case, but it's already getting worse, and if I put more dephasing in, it will get even worse. Okay, so this is an observation, that's a general observation here. A bit of noise is good, too much is not good. Okay, so, and this is actually the theme that I want to develop now a little bit further and move it over to the biological setting. Because really, I mean, maybe the most important open system on this planet is actually life, where you really, by necessity, all the components of your system are in contact with an environment. And now the question is, can some of these principles that I've shown here, so that a little bit of noise can be good for you, does this play any role in biological systems, together with the presence of potential quantum mechanical dynamics? So, so I look at a very simplified view of nature, of course. I'm a theorist, after all, a theoretical physicist. So here are proteins. Here are molecules that will support electronic excitations. And the protein has the function of bringing those molecules into a spatial arrangement. So it creates an electronic network where it adjusts the distances, the orientations, and so on. And so this is actually what nature constructs for you. And then, now let's have a look. Can there actually be any dephasing playing a role? So it's clear that we have electronic sites. They can interact coherently if they're close enough to each other, but where does the decoherence come from precisely? And it actually comes from the fact that nature has control over the spatial arrangement of this system. So here's one of those molecules that's sitting held in this protein structure. But of course, you know that protein is at a finite temperature, so it's holding this molecule, but of course, the protein is moving a little bit. That means that this molecule is moving a little bit, it changes its orientations a little bit, but even worse, the distance between the molecule and parts of the protein may change. And of course, you have chemical bonds there, and you have partial charges. That means that the excitation energy on this molecule will change in time, and it changes randomly. And that means it leads to a dephasing type of noise on the system, simply because of the fact that the protein is not an absolutely rigid body, and it is at a room temperature. And so what you will find is that this is here a typical spectral density of those of this noise. So there's some broad part, which is kind of general, sort of, or can also be from water and so on. And there are some sharp peaks that are typically from intramolecular vibrational motions. So you have both components, broad background that is more like a more non-Markovian noise, or at least is less Markovian, and then you have these sharp features which have a much longer memory time in them, and both will play a role in what I will tell you afterwards. So now let's have a look a little bit more of a look at the dynamics of this system, and this is now a little bit more going beyond these nuclear spins, But I want to see here how the vibrational degrees of freedom are actually collaborating with the electronic degrees of freedom, again, to facilitate transport through the system. And so here we have a very simple, I stripped away the protein. So here I have an arrangement of molecules. I have an input, I put excitation in here, and at the end I suck it out. And I want to improve or optimize the transport dynamics. So when I have three sites, and I have one excitation in them, let's say, then I will have three energy levels that are determined by distances, relative orientations, and the dipolar interaction between those systems. Okay, so now this is the arrangement, and let's say we have our spectral density of our vibrations, and I showed you at the beginning, for low frequencies, the spectral density is rather low, because actually the vibrations don't couple so well to separate sites. And for high frequencies, it's low because there's a maximum frequency at which the mechanical structure can vibrate, and somewhere in between there are maxima. So let's have a look at this. So there we have this situation. And here we have our excitation initially in this state here, and we would like to go down here, but we have to pay an energy penalty for that. So let's say if we go down, we would lose some energy, and this has to go somewhere. If it cannot go somewhere, we cannot make the transition by energy preservation. And if there's nothing else in the environment, no vibrational modes of that frequency, then we cannot make this transition. Now, nature can go along and say, let's change the protein a little bit. Let's change the orientations a bit and tune the system. And now we can tune the electronic levels such that they can interact in the best possible way with the vibrational degrees of freedom. And if we increase this splitting here, such that it matches a maximum of the vibration of the spectral density, now we have plenty of space where we can dump the energy difference, and we can make this transition and thereby facilitate transport through the system. So now again, here you would say, aha, on the one hand, I need some quantum mechanical dynamics here, namely to create these eigenstates and to, by changing the couplings and so on, shift the energy differences and thereby adjust them to the vibrational environment. On the other hand, I need a vibrational environment, some form of noise, basically, to interact with, to dump my energy difference in. So there has to be some noise, there has to be some coherence. If I make the system pure, perfect in the sense there are no vibrations, then there will be no dynamics. If I have very strong vibrations, it will actually completely disrupt the coherence, and I will not be able to tune my electronic system anymore. The states will never split, and therefore I cannot actually adjust them to the maximum of the spectral density. And so again, you can see here that in this is another situation where system-environment interaction should be at an intermediate level to deliver optimal performance for the system. So these are examples. So here was the example from the spin system where I have dark states and they may not propagate, so I need noise to release them, and you can make a theory and then you can see that there's really an intermediate optimum level. This is what I've just shown you, the tuning of the electronic system to the vibrations. And also what you can say in a very simple rate integration picture, if you have two states and they are not on resonance, and they are oscillating and vibrating varying in energy, sometimes they will be close to resonance and you can have transfer. And again, this is a mechanism by which even classically external noise can help you to transfer through the system. And in each case, you find these observations. For these kind of transport, polarization, diffusion properties, it's really typically the optimal point of performance is somewhere in between where the noise system-environment interaction is roughly of the same strength as the interaction between coherent interaction between system components. Okay, and so that's an observation. But now the question, of course, is biology like that? Maybe biology is so noisy that it's completely irrelevant, and what I'm telling you makes no sense whatsoever. And this is a typical reaction what I'm getting in the quantum technologies community, because we are used to this. Trapped ions, super cold, ultra high vacuum, shielded from magnetic field fluctuations, everything. And clearly noise is not what we like here. But this is because we really want to have a long quantum computation that we are carrying out. So long time coherence for information processing purposes. In biology, we are really much more interested in short phenomena, I mean, fast phenomena. So, for example, exciton transfer, electron transfer, and these sort of things, they take place in the femtosecond, picosecond range. Electron spin phenomena, maybe, I mean, nanoseconds or so. Nuclear spins, microseconds. I mean, so really much, much shorter. And that's okay then, because if the time scale is short enough, I mean, if I take my hand and I put it on a hot plate by accident and I pull it away immediately, it's not a problem. I feel that it was warm, but I did not really thermalize with a hot plate, and so nothing happens. If I keep my hand on it because I put too much weight on it in the first moment, I will burn. And then my tissue will be broken. And so here it's the same. If the process is fast enough, it can actually use quantum coherence and perhaps also some influence from noise for its task. So that's an important point. Coherence in the brain, I think this is a very, very long shot. This would require far too long times, but for these short processes, there it might actually really play a role. And so let's check this. So there are some ideas where this may indeed play a role. I don't know what that means.
9 minutes.
9 minutes left. Okay. Sorry, 10 minutes left?
Nine.
Okay, perfect. Okay, so one application area for these ideas is photosynthesis, both for the transport of excitons, but perhaps more importantly, for the process of charge separation, where the exciton is eventually turned into separated charges. And here, system-environment interaction and coherent dynamics are likely to really show an interesting interplay. There are ideas for how actually electron transport in interaction with phonons, so vibrations, may actually provide an underlying mechanism for our sense of smell, or at least, let's say, for molecular recognition. And I will explain you how the idea goes. And then also, there are ideas, for example, concerning magnetoreception of animals, where we don't really know how they're doing this. And one idea is that it's actually related to electron spin physics. But again, although I cannot go into detail here, if these electron spins would just suffer a pure quantum mechanical dynamics, this mechanism would not work. What is absolutely crucial here is the interaction of those spins with the nuclear spins in the underlying protein that they are excited on. So this is, an important part. So in fact, for all of these mechanisms, they work best when there is quantum dynamics and a bit of noise. But let's have a look now, because I want to convince you that this is not completely far-fetched, that there's even some experimental evidence that really there is coherence, coherent dynamics, and that there is, of course, also noise. And how do we do this? Well, the best evidence we have is from photosynthesis, and the reason is that we have excitons there, they interact nicely with light, and we have ultra-fast spectroscopy, so we can really study these very, very fast processes and get some information from them. And so how do we do this? And this is typically done by what is called two-dimensional electronic spectroscopy. Now, loosely speaking, that means we send three laser pulses into the system, we vary their time separation, we assume that they're very short, and we probe the system with a fourth pulse, basically. And that actually is our mode of examination. And why does this give us interesting information? Well, this you can learn from this little fellow. Actually, what this really does is the following. Take the swing where Kelvin is sitting, and if you push it suddenly, then it starts to swing, and then after a while it comes back, and if it's here and you push again, you will get a larger amplitude. And then it comes back again, you push again, get even larger amplitude. That's fine, but if you do it again, you push, it goes up, it comes back here, and now you push, then you stop the motion. So depending on the rate that you're pushing the system, you will get either a large or a small amplitude, okay? And so you're basically using resonance phenomena to find out what are the eigenfrequencies of the system, and you can equally see when you would have Kelvin and, let's say, his little girlfriend, whose name I've forgotten, when they're sitting on neighboring swings and they would hold hands and you push one, after a while the other one would follow. And you can also learn something about coupling between systems in this manner. So this is the layman's sort of simple explanation of this. You can do an analysis of that with perturbation theory, typically, and you can work out all the answers. And there have been experiments of that type that have actually really now studied the dynamics of the system given these pulses. And now, typically, you will observe the following. So you will have here some nice plots, and here is the axis that corresponds to the time separation between the first two pulses, and this is the axis that relates to the time separation between this pulse and that pulse. So you scan this over different time separations, you have your data points, you make the Fourier transform, so these are Fourier frequency axes here, and then what you will see is you will have eigenfrequencies on the diagonal, you will have off-diagonal terms, that means one side got excited, it transferred some of its energy the other side to the another side, and there it was re-emitted, basically. And so this shows coupling. And if you now look at these sides here, and you look at the amplitude as a function of the waiting between the second and third pulse, then you can see in some experiments something like that, that actually these amplitudes are going up and down and oscillate coherently. And that is a strong signature for some coherent dynamics going on in this system. But of course, these oscillations are also damped. That means there's also dephasing noise in this system. So both things are present. The discussion at present in the field is a little bit, what is the precise nature of these coherences? Is it electronic purely? Is it electron vibrational? Is it vibrational? And the truth will be that it's all the three of them intermixed, and a lot of the effort that has to be done is also now to understand more detailed what these responses really mean quantitatively. Okay, so now, how can a vibration play a role here? Well, if I have this spectral density here, I have my energy levels, and I have a very long-lived vibrational motion that has an energy which is exactly the energy difference between those two levels, then we will of course go down. But of course, also the excitation can go into the vibrational mode, but it can also come back. And so here you have, like in cavity QED of an atom interacting with the cavity mode, you will have a coherent exchange that gradually is damped out by the overall dephasing noise. Okay, so now, what could this be useful for, actually? Now I want to turn this around and turn this into a detector. Okay. So here, imagine a very abstracted protein, membrane protein, which has a binding pocket here. It has, let's say, an electron source, an electron acceptor, and initially, let's say, my electron is sitting up here, and it would like to go down here, but again, it cannot lose the energy difference to anything. So let's say the system is designed such that there are no vibrational frequencies that match this energy difference. Now, a molecule comes along. And if this molecule happens to have a vibrational mode that matches this energy difference, then now the electron can move and the molecular vibration can be excited. And if this molecular vibration is then damped at the right rate, it will actually not drive the electron back. So again, you need a bit of damping because otherwise you just have coherent oscillations between those levels. So this is a very simple thought of how maybe a biological system may sense the presence of a molecule with a particular vibrational motion. And perhaps, just perhaps, this can play a role in our sense of smell. There are not much direct proofs for this. Let's say none, probably. There's indirect suggestions that this might be correct. But it's an interesting way, again, where system and environment have to collaborate, vibrational environment, electronic system, such that you can get a useful function. Okay, so now the last 5 minutes or four probably, I would like to spend on one point because I want to drive it very quickly back to, 1 minute, okay. I want to drive it back to simulation, and this may actually, we can get this by in a minute or so. There is actually also a simulation challenge here. One particular challenge that I want to allude to here is the one of actually computing these 2D spectra. If you want to compute those 2D spectra for a system which has maybe 5 sites and a reasonably realistic spectral density for each of these sites, you need a very big computer already. It's already a very challenging problem to get quantitatively correct answers for those 2D spectra. If you want to go to 10 sites, I think this is already not really possible anymore, unless you oversimplify at some point. If you want to have accurate answer, that's already the limit. So it would therefore be interesting to try and build quantum simulators or emulators that actually, where you construct a particular electronic system with a particular vibrational environment, and then let it go and actually measure on that system, and in that way obtain your 2D spectra information that you can otherwise not compute. So first steps in this direction are two papers here. So one is from the Innsbruck group around Blatt and Roos, and another one is from the ETH group around Andreas Wallraff. And they have looked at very simple, well, not actually not so simple systems, but I mean systems where they can look at the dynamics of the spin system, and they exerted external noise, so in a way a classical noise from the outside, and looked at some of these phenomena like a noise-assisted transport and so on, and taken first steps to build quantum simulators for these biological dynamics. But I think we have to go a step further, because an important part of this system-environment interaction is really a coherent exchange where the environment affects the system, and the system affects the environment, and there's a coherent exchange between those things. And one way of doing this is to create a spin boson model in a trapped ion setting, and the way we are proposing to do this is to actually use laser-cooled vibrational modes of the trapped ion system, so as to be able to take several of those, superimpose them, and create complex spectral densities in an efficient way. And you can approximate with these damped harmonic modes, you can approximate spectral densities very, very well, and you can also prove mathematically that this is an appropriate way to represent the environment. And with that, I would like to come to the concluding slide, namely, from my point of view, also this quantum dynamics in biology is interesting, because here we have big machines. Now we go to very small machines which run faster, they're smaller, they're more quantum mechanical, but they're also more susceptible to fluctuations and noise. And there's an interesting interplay between coherent dynamics and the environment. And so new experimental tools are needed to study this, numerical modeling and quantum simulation may be needed, and from that we learn design principles, how nature might have gone about these things. And with that I would like to close. That's the group in Ulm, and this is the new Center for Quantum Biosciences in Ulm that we will move in a month's time, where some of this research will continue. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Martin. Yeah, we have already the first question.
It seems like ultracold molecules in optical lattices already provide you with a number of interfacing timescales and different kinds of spin structures. Have you thought about that platform as a quantum simulator in order to investigate the kinds of questions that you're addressing?
So that could be, but you also have to have a way to create local quantum mechanical environments for each of those molecules. So I'm not entirely sure, I'm not an expert on that particular area. So, but this is the extra ingredient that you would have to put in. So in the ion trap, that is those are the vibrational modes of the trapped ion crystal, of which you have several. If you have something similar in those particular systems that you can control well, that you can also broaden by cooling, for example, then you are on a good track to actually devise such a quantum simulator.
Okay, so if you had cold molecules and then you ultracold molecules and then you had them, in a sea of unpaired atoms, for example, would the Bose condensate in a controlled enough way provide that kind of reservoir or no?
Would that still be a local environ?
It depends on how you do it in the lattice.
This is also interesting, but it would be nice that you can actually then tune between global and local environment.
Okay.
But I'm sure that something, with enough tricks and so on, I'm sure that something can be done there.
Mm-hmm.
And then you would indeed have a quantum simulator that at least could address some of these questions.
And do the timescales have to be separated in, by three orders of magnitude? Of course, this was a loose estimate that you put up. Could it be one or two orders of magnitude? Or do you really need...
Which timescales do you...
Well, you have the nuclear, the electronic, the... Right. Okay. Each of these was a different time scale in your system.
Right. So, let's say in the true biological system, the difference is about a factor of between 10 and 100.
Oh, fine.
Yeah. So it's not much more than that, because, the optical frequency is about 10,000 wave numbers, one electron volt, And the largest vibrational frequencies are maybe 0.1, 0.2 electron volts, and then anything below. And high and low frequency modes can play a role in these things.
Okay, thank you.
Hi. So I'm just trying to understand the relation of the first part of the talk to maybe what Professor Rattrap was kind of talking about earlier on. So in the scenario that you were considering, you would still, even if you didn't have this dephasing to kind of help polarize the entire system, you would still see it saturate to one in terms of the NV polarization at late times, right? So I guess this, in this sense, does it explain the So for example, in this no dephasing case.
Okay, so here we are,
So in this case, it's true that you have a dark state that you don't pump into, but the NV is blocked from leaking polarization into the system.
Well,
still,
I mean, so at some point, the sides, let's say in this case, the single side is that the NV is interacting with is polarized, but this polarization does not diffuse anymore. So actually dynamics stop simply. And what will have happened if everything really is coherent, that all the rest of the lattice is basically in a dark state for diffusion. Yeah. And actually, when you look at a large lattice, you will find that with a very large probability, there will be these dark states. Actually, a large majority of the states are dark states. So you actually really don't polarize very effectively. Yeah. Unless you have disorders or static disorder, energy differences, you put in local dephasing or some other means of breaking these dark states.
There was a John.
So at the end of your talk, you talked about the potential interests in doing a quantum simulation, possibly on trapped ions, and then there have been these experiments at a Reiner Blotz group that have illustrated the idea nicely of vibrational assistance energy transfer. But I got the impression that your claim was that one can do a more rigorous simulation where maybe you can map a light harvesting complex onto a trapped ion quantum simulator.
Of course, you will always make a model of the light harvesting complex. That's clear. So the first thing I should maybe emphasize again, so I mean, as beautiful as these experiments are, the noise that is exerted on the quantum dynamics there is, in a sense, a classical noise. It's externally fluctuating fields. So these fields are not affected by the spin, by the state of the spin system. In biological system, that is certainly wrong. In the biological system, whether there's an exciton or not will have a direct effect on the nuclear motion. And therefore, there's a back and forth. There's an interaction. There's an effect on the nuclear motion, and there is an effect back. And in some cases, this is a very important component. And I think if you want to make a true quantum simulation of such a system, this at least has to be taken into account. That's the first requirement. So you want to have a true quantum mechanical environment. And then secondly, of course, you have to really be able to mimic or approximate well the spectral density that you have for these nuclear motions. And the important is, on the one hand, you have a relatively, you know, continuous background. And then you have these relatively long-lived, relatively sharp modes. So you have to be able to, you should be able to do both in the same system. Yeah, not only broadband noise, but also not only delta correlated, like in ion trap. I mean, it would be easy to say, okay, vibrational mode is almost, it's extremely long-lived. That will give me a delta function system. But then you also want to have something broader. And that's why we brought in the laser cooling to actually controlled way broaden the mode and thereby interpolate between these things. But one mode will not be enough. You need several to approximate complex, more complex spectral densities. And then what I'm saying is, for such a model, I could, of course, say I put this on a computer. But if I have 10 electronic sites and, let's say, 3 or 4 modes per site, I would not know how to really simulate this well on a classical computer anymore.
So, a general question of method. So, It looks here that there are many different orders of magnitude that are covered. I mean, from your proteins to the down to the quantum effects that that you described, and also the, mm-hmm. the interaction with the open system, etc. So would you feel that in order to describe the whole thing, so imagine to have this biological system, and perhaps this biological system can also be interfaced with something that is not biological mm-hmm. in nature. Would you feel that one should set up a multi-method a methodological environment that is made up of several methods, I don't know, molecular dynamics on one side, density yeah. functional theory to get mm-hmm. the electronic structure, and then all what you have described
yeah, here. Absolutely. So, I mean, actually a while ago we had a ESF from the European Science Foundation, when it still existed, we made a sort of a workshop where we discussed what is needed to be done. And then we wrote a report, and one of the things is exactly this, because actually what kind of the kind of simulation that I showed you here is in the intermediate level. So we already say, okay, this is the spectral density, so we have abstracted away the protein and the environment to some extent. This of course can be supplemented by these parameters for these models can either come from experiment or from first principles simulations. This would be a combination of molecular dynamics with electron structure DFT calculations, so where the protein is moving, and in every configuration you recalculate the electronic states, then you work out what is the excitation energy on the sides, and this, some people are doing this, is extremely cumbersome, very hard. So if one have a quantum simulation for that, it would also be fantastic. So that would be the bottom layer. Then there would be the first effective layer is this kind of simulations that we are doing. And then above that, for larger length scales and longer time scales, there would have to be another effective layer which takes some information from here and places them, for example, into rate equations or so, that are then governing the long time limit, where we really do not believe so much that there's a very strong quantum coherence living. It's just that some of the processes, some of the input parameters for the dynamical equations are informed by the lower level, by the quantum mechanical properties. And so I think this is really important, and it's very challenging, because all these communities speak completely different languages, and it's not so easy to make them, you know, combine their tools.
So to go back to the simulation or the simulator question, I'm just trying to understand. So typically when you talk about quantum computation or simulation of secondless matter problems, the standard argument is that the scaling will become challenging, and therefore we need a quantum mm-hmm. simulator eventually. Mm-hmm. Here I understand there is the scaling of exponential scaling in the number of sites, but I mean there is no family of molecules of increasing size that do these things, right? I mean there are families certain sizes, mm-hmm. and then at some point there are no more bigger molecules. So I'm trying
well,
to understand.
Well, I wouldn't say that there are no bigger ones anymore, but I mean you can have membranes and so on. But I take your point in the sense that of course we will not, I mean it's not likely that we will have a 10,000 site vibrational system. But I don't mind, because already when it's 10 sites, it's so difficult that I really, if I want to have quantitative answers, I need something else than just a classical computer. So this is a nice problem where maybe also my quantum simulator doesn't have to be quite as large as for many of these other condensed matter problems, where you really want to have, want to have maybe 100 by 100 or so. That's probably not what we really need here. So in that sense, we may be useful. The quantum simulator is useful for intermediate size system, and the simulator itself will be intermediate size.
Okay. So you showed this two-tone spectroscopic data, and my understanding is there was some controversy. It's experimental data, right? But I understand there was some controversy that the original experimental results maybe were not correct. Can you update us on this? I mean, people claim it was like 10 times shorter coherence times than what they claim.
Okay,
right?
So I think you refer to Dwayne Miller and, okay.
Has this been settled
Okay, so I would like to say the following to that. So Dwayne Miller and these experiments have not been done exactly on the same system under exactly the same parameters as the original experiments. So the direct comparison is already limited. Now, what they have done is they have taken a complex, they have done spectroscopy, they have supported it by theory, by numerical simulation. So in itself, it's certainly consistent, or at least as far as I can judge. However, the claim that in their experiment they do not see long-lived vibrational coherence does not mean that the other experiments are wrong. And it also does not allow to generalize this claim from this one experiment to the entire realm of biology. And to make it really extreme, I would like to give you an idea of let's say, imagine we take an ion trap. And we know in an ion trap we can have spin motion coupling. Now I set up an experiment and I take a laser pulse and I shoot it on the ion on resonance, on the carrier frequency, and I see there doesn't seem to be spin motion coupling. And from that I would then could then conclude, there is no such thing. What I mean to say is, if you probe your system in an unfavorable regime, not intentionally, but I mean just happens to be in an unfavorable regime, you may not see the spin motion coupling. But if you probe it in a different regime, namely in the ion trap, you shine on the red sideband or the blue sideband, then you see spin motion coupling. So I think here the situation is that the experiments that they have done, the situation that they have probed, did not seem particularly conducive to, you know, showing spin electron vibrational coupling in this way. But there are, so we have been involved in some experiments where I'm confident that I'm happy that we have seen electron vibrational coupling, and even better, we have been able, in this case it was an artificial system, but still, we have been able to separate different hypotheses. We could have, there was the electron vibrational hypothesis, there was an alternative, and then we tried to match both of them in the best way to the available data, and then it was clear that the electron vibrational coupling won. And so this is a way to show that one model might be more likely than the other. So there are two alternatives and one is removed. And I would say this has not really happened in these particular experiments. So I don't want to say that anything they have done is wrong, but I would say they have probed it in an unfortunate, unfortunate choice of parameters.
So,
but there is still discussion, of course.
This
yes.
seems
sorry?
To be sorry. Pardon? This seems to be a good point to stop. There is the breakout session after lunch, which is waiting for us. So let's thank both speakers again.